We've taken our good old radio microphones out to the bright new Hyatt Regency O'Hare and the Blue Max for a chat with one of the most popular musicians of our time. Vaughn Monroe, hello.
How are you, Chuck?
I'm just fine. Hello, how are you from all your friends out in Chicagoland?
Well, we've been coming to Chicago for so long that I feel that we are not strangers to a lot of people out here after having played the Oriental for many years and then moving over to the Chicago when the Oriental changed their policy. And the Aragon Ballroom and the, what was the old Sherman, the, what'd they call it?
Man, the Boulevard Room?
Panther.
College.
College. That's something like that, yes. And that was our first trip to Chicago when the band was brand new. But we've been coming here for many, many years.
When did you play the Oriental and the Chicago?
Our first job at the Oriental was 1942.
42.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, that was... you were half of the top half of a bill with a movie, I bet, at the time, huh?
That's right.
Yeah. Boy, those were great days. I remember going to the Oriental and to the Chicago and waiting in at the stage door, you know, for to get the autographs. And
the stage door at the Oriental was in the alley. Remember the,
yeah,
the dark alley behind the theater?
Uh-huh.
And we used to stand out there in the cold, sign autographs for some time.
Well, it was a great treat to get an autograph from a big star like Vaughn Monroe. It's great fun. Everyone knows of your great success as a vocalist and band leader. Just how did you get started in the music business?
Well, I picked up an old cornet from a friend of mine when I was 11 years old in Kent, Ohio, and I was going to learn bugle calls on it so I could play in this drum and bugle corps that he was going to organize. We were all about 11 years old. And of course, it wasn't a bugle. It was actually a cornet with three valves on it. Of course, I started fooling around with this particular thing and making horrible noises down in the basement. So my father said, if you're going to really get interested in this thing, I'm going to have you take lessons so at least you won't sound so bad. And I started taking lessons then. And by the time I was 15, I'd won the state championship for Wisconsin, where we'd moved in the meantime. My second year in high school at Cuddy, Wisconsin. And I'd won the state championship for Wisconsin as a trumpet soloist. And from there on, it was just one of those things. We moved to Gannett, Pennsylvania when I was in my junior year, before my junior year in high school, and got in the high school band and in the glee club. And while I was there, I used to play solos in church for our choir director. And she heard me humming one day back in the choir room before we went on to the into the church. And she said, I need a bass singer. Why don't you join the choir and sing bass for me? I said, all right, fine, you know. Well, before I knew it, she and her husband were both voice teachers. As a matter of fact, they were originally from Chicago here and had moved to Gannett, Pennsylvania. And Mr. and Mrs. Smith gave me vocal lessons for nothing. I mean, free. Matter of fact, I couldn't afford them at that time. And by the time I got ready to go to college, I became very much interested in voice, and they encouraged me to carry on with a vocal career. So I majored in voice at Carnegie Tech for 2 years until I had to leave school. Then I studied whenever I had a chance with the good teachers around the country that I'd come in contact with. And finally in 1937, after knocking around the country with bands, territory bands, as we call them, Larry Funk and the Band of 1,000 Melodies and Austin Wiley, I decided that we'd spent some time in Boston playing prior to that, year 35, and I decided to go back to Boston. I'd been offered a job there playing trumpet in a society band, Jack Michaud's society band. So I decided that I'd go back to school, so I enrolled at New England Conservatory in Boston and played nights for about 4 years there, back and forth between Cape Cod and a spot in Boston, and then a winter's in Miami Beach. And finally, in the spring of, or actually January of 1940, my the boy I played for, Jack Michaud, came to Florida and he said, let's start a big band. He said, I just feel the time is ripe for a big band, and they don't have any really singing band leaders. They have Harry James on a trumpet and Charlie Spivak and Jimmy and Tommy Dorsey, all instrumentalists. He said, I think it might just be about the right time for a vocal leader. So we organized the band, and April of 1940, and just 8 days before that, I married my The girl I'd gone to high school with my junior and senior year was from Gannett, Pennsylvania. And in 1940, we decided to get married after having known each other for 12 years. Finally decided that we liked each other. Marion Monroe. And we were married, and 8 days later, we started a big band in a little spot outside of Boston. And we were lucky to get a network wire for broadcasting out
was
of this,
this
place.
Was this from a place called 10 Acres?
Siler's 10 Acres.
Siler's, yes. 10 mm-hmm. Acres.
And we broadcast that whole summer about three times a week. And, of course, we were brand new, and people said, well, where'd this thing come from? Uh-huh. But we had a very fine arranger who had been with Jan Sabbat. Mm-hmm. And, of course, with our band, he had a free rein, and he wrote his style and gave the band some character, you know. And all that summer, then in May, my partner decided that he'd go to New York and try to get us a record contract. So through many manipulations, he got us a test pressing for RCA Victor. So we went and did two sides and sent them around, as we did at that time, mm-hmm. to the disc jockeys and things. Although there weren't so many disc jockeys in 1940. There were three or four big ones. Eddie out of Chicago here. Well, anyway. And Martin Block out of New York, WNEW. Mm-hmm. And
Eddie Hubbard, are you
Eddie Hubbard, uh-huh. yes. And Martin took a shine to one of our records and started playing it on his make-believe ballroom in New York. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, the following June, we're in the Paramount Theater in New York. Uh-huh. And followed that with Frank Daly's Meadowbrook, which were the two important spots for a new band.
Let's back up to the Paramount Theater in New York. I read something about a pretty exciting experience that you had at the Paramount Theater. Were you nearly trampled to death there?
Well, do you know the Paramount Theater at all? It had a rising stage. Uh-huh. It came from way down in a pit about, uh-huh. 20 feet below the level of the audience. And you started your theme song, and the band came up on this rising platform, and when you were just level with the first row, you could step over it and go into the theater yourself, or vice versa. Uh-huh. You could step over the first row and get on the stage. And this one particular Saturday morning, we had a terrific crowd of youngsters, and they were screaming and yelling, and we were playing the theme song going down, and we're waving, you know, a bit. Uh-huh. And all of a sudden, a wave of youngsters came over that stage just as we hit the right level, and they were grabbing music and cymbals and drumsticks, and one, I had a knit tie, I remember. And one girl had one side of it and pulling, and the other one had the other side, and they're pulling against me. And in the meantime, I'm getting red in the face and choking to death, practically. Well, the stagehands finally got them away from me, and we loosened my tie. And my shirt was torn, and they had pieces of my shirt. It was real fun. But it wasn't fun for a while. It was really scary.
Well, I bet you were pretty frightened, yeah.
And we had to take the kids, there must have been 30 of them on the stage or the platform. We took them out through the stage door, which they got a bigger kick out of that than anything, I think.
Is it true you lost a pair of cufflinks in that?
Oh, yes, they took my cufflinks. Never did get those back. And one of the drummers lost one of his very fine Zildjian cymbals that cost probably about $50. They never did find the boy that took that. And the boys are grabbing their horns and protecting their instruments, you know. And, of course, the saxophone player has about three horns that he has to pick up and hold. So it was real hairy for a while.
Yeah, but that's kind of a great experience to look back on, I think.
Yes, it is.
You know, if they didn't care, they wouldn't do it either, I guess. So
that's very true. And, of course, we were thrilled to death after it all happened, but we were scared.
Yeah, I can imagine. All right, then from the Paramount, you went to Commodore Theater?
Well,
I mean,
we went to Frank Daly's Meadowbrook, which is on the Pompton Turnpike in New Jersey, uh-huh. and that was one of the top spots for bands. And out of the Meadowbrook, we must have had 12 national broadcasts a week, CBS, NBC, and ABC.
A dozen a week?
Yeah.
My goodness. Every
we never got off the air. We didn't get paid much, but we got a lot of airtime, which was the thing we wanted for the one-nighter tour, which we were coming up with following that. We didn't win the Commodore until that fall of 1941, mm-hmm. and we stayed through until after New Year's that year. And then for seven consecutive years, we did the same thing. We come in the beginning of football season and wind up probably the week after New Year's.
It was more or less your base.
It was our base,
operation.
Yes.
I read in a July 1941 issue of Metronome magazine a review of your performance at the at the Meadowbrook by George T. Simon.
George Simon.
Right. And he said that Vaughn Monroe was the Rudy Valley of the new generation. Did you feel like the Rudy Valley of the new generation?
Well, at that time, I didn't know how I felt. We were awfully busy and working very hard. And I remember George Simon's review. As a matter of fact, I think George had part of it in that big band book that he wrote
later on.
That's
right.
Yes. Uh-huh. And I think he quoted that same phrase in his book. So, well, we had many different comments about my singing during those days from the critics and the commentators, because I had studied legitimate voice so long that I still retained a certain timbre or approach to a pop song that they thought was pretty corny. And so my manager decided to do something about it, so we hired a coach. And for one summer, every day he coached me and tried to take that particular style away from me, you know. And I guess he did partly, but not completely.
Well, I'm glad that he didn't, because we think your style is tremendous. That's Vaughn Monroe. What about all those people who impersonated you over the years? That was a standard part of business for anyone who was doing impersonations.
In the beginning, I used to get pretty mad about it, quite angry about it. I thought they were really poking fun at me, and you know, and true by for true, you know. But as time went on, and more and more people began to do it, I got a big kick out of it. I still do.
That's what they say. Imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. What was the first record you cut?
The first one was If You See Margie. That was the title, Tell Her I'm Coming Home. And on the back side of that was A Gentleman Needs a Shave.
I beg your pardon. Was that on the... See, recorded...
That was on Bluebird label.
Bluebird.
That was the orchestral... label that R.C. Victor pressed Glenn Miller and all the bands on, Sammy Kay. And it was, at that time, it was the whole sum of 39 cents for the Bluebird label. And Victor cost about 55, I think.
It was way up there. Yeah. How did you you develop the Racing with the Moon as your theme song?
Well, my arranger was quite a writer, Johnny Watson, and he had written a lot of things that had been published and played by Jan Sabbat. One was It's a Wonderful World, remember that? Mm-hmm. And 720 in the Books. And they were quite popular on the air with the Jan Sabbat band. So Johnny had the title in mind, and we sat down one Sunday and decided we wanted the theme song of our own. And he said, well, how about Racing with the Moon? So we fooled around a little bit, and pretty soon we had the first eight bars, and that became our theme song. And then, as time went on, people wanted to hear more of it, so we had to finish out the whole chorus and put lyrics to it. And that's how it came to be.
Boy, it's been a permanent personal property of Vaughn Monroe all these years.
Yes, I don't think anybody else has ever done it.
No. Well, that's good. You did lots of radio work all along the line as you were doing your one-nighters and from... wherever you were based, at the Commodore or the Meadowbrook or whatever.
Well, in 1941, for about 39 weeks, we had a radio show for Camel Cigarettes. It was the old Bob Hawke show called Limac.
Oh, yeah.
And we were on for about 39 weeks, and then during the war, they didn't use the band at all for the shows. Then in 1946, they called us back, and we were on the air on our own. And we broadcast from Army bases and air bases and every week on Saturday night at 7:30. And that went on until from 1946. Then we switched over after a while to college campuses. And we hit practically every major and minor college in the country. We did a broadcast from there on Saturday nights. And that went on until 1954.
That was about the end of the so-called big band sound.
Yes,
era,
that's right.
Right? Mm-hmm. What about this motorcycle business in Vaughn Monroe? I guess you're kind of interested in motorcycles, aren't you?
Well, we went out in 1943 to Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer to make a picture. And the only house we could get at the time, rent, was up in a canyon about 20 miles from the studio. And, of course, gas was racing and very short, and we had no... we needed one car for Marion and the children, the girls, to... well, as a matter of fact, Christy wasn't even born then. Candy was about 3 years old, our oldest daughter. So she needed a car, but she drove me to the studio the first day, and when I got the parking lot, the yard was filled with motorcycles, the MGM parking lot. So when I came out that night, I said to the gate man, I said, who do all those motorcycles belong to? He said, well, that one's Clark Gables, and that one's Robert Taylor's, and this is Keenan Wynn's, and he went on with all, because they were, really, they had to conserve gas, too, so they all rode motorcycles to the studio. So that weekend, I went out, and I bought an old clunker and rode back and forth to the studio for 6 weeks while we did the picture. And I liked it so well, I sent it back to New York. And I used to ride from our home up in Park Avenue to the Strand Theater and go home for dinner. And everybody said, oh, you're crazy, because, you know, everybody considered motorcycles a real nut thing. And I eventually took it to Boston and rode it up there. And now it's in the later one. The fourth one I had is now in the museum in Stuart, Florida, in a vehicular museum. It was the last one of the Indians made in this country. So I gave it to the museum.
Do you ever feel like you'd like to get on a cycle again and take a ride?
Oh, I can go over and take a ride on any time I want. It's still in working condition.
Maybe someone on their way out to the Blue Max here will look down the Kennedy Expressway and see Vaughn Monroe racing with the moon again.
You won't see me on the Kennedy Expressway with it. Although one time we recorded a song called Black Leather Jacket and Motorcycle Boots. And for a publicity stunt, Life magazine asked me to do this thing for them out in the West Coast, and we were going up and down the freeways with a car with a top down and the cameraman in there taking pictures of me going along the freeway. And it appeared in Life. And the finale of it was, the last picture was a pair of boots and a leather jacket and a hat lying in the highways by themselves.
That's showbiz. Well, you made a very easy transition from radio to television with the talents of Vaughn Monroe. You were one of the very early television regulars, and didn't I read someplace that you were on one of the first color television programs, or one of the really early color
We
things?
Did the first actual band show on CBS in 1950 and 51. We were the first band that ever did anything live on television. Then later on, when I became the representative for Radio Corporation of America for color TV, I did all the color commercials, and I'm very proud to say that I did the first color commercial that was ever done out of the color studio at Burbank for RCA. And I would say we're a pioneer. We haven't had a regular show for quite some time, but we get an occasional guest shot.
Oh, sure. Well, you had
Marion and I, my wife, who's my manager, my actual honest to goodness manager, and I travel together, and we have a lot of fun just traipsing around the country. When we come back to Chicago, we have friends here. We have friends most everywhere we go, and she takes care of all my business and leaves me to do the singing.
And you do it so well.
She says, go out there, get out there and sing. You'll do everything else to me, you know.
She does a good job on that, too, then, I guess. What's next for Vaughn Monroe? Where do you go from the Blue Max?
We are going, in just the week after we leave here, we are going to Virginia Beach, the Cavalier Hotel, for 2 weeks. And then we have a couple of days off, and then we go to Disneyland out at in California for 10 days. And then we take off for the summer, we hope.
Well, good. We're glad that you've found a place to find a couple of weeks in the Chicago area, and we just enjoyed the show we saw before we had a chance to chat with you. It's great.
Well, just before we came in here, we were 3 weeks at the Regency Hyatt in Atlanta, which was the first one of this type of hotel, you know, the spectacular lobbies and the new concept in hotels. And we just came up from there, and now we have these 2 weeks here. They're building a new one in Houston, and we'll probably be down there, too. But we take quite a bit of time off. We take a lot of cruises. We went to the North Cape, on the North Cape cruise, which took in all of the Scandinavian countries and Russia and Germany last year. And this September we're going on the on the Gripsholm to Spain, Portugal, North Africa, and that trip back through Bermuda. So even though we work hard when we work, we have a lot of fun when we're off. And we have a beautiful home in Florida, which is right on the St. Lucie River. And we have our boat, and we have saltwater fishing and freshwater fishing, and we just think it's great.
Sounds like you're a man who has just about everything you could want. The chance to sing when you want to and to relax when you wanted to.
Well, when you stop and think that how many years I've been doing this, it's about time I... There were years, you know, when we had the band when we didn't take more than a week off a year, and that's pretty grueling. So now I don't have the band to worry about as far as any responsibility to a band, and it's just Mary and myself. Both girls are married.
Uh-huh.
And we just more or less do what we want to.
Well, keep doing it and include Chicago in your agenda again next time.
I just told somebody today that I take off when Marion wants to. When she decides it's time to take off, then we take off.
Well, we'll shout the praises of Vaughn Monroe at the Blue Max and get everybody from Chicagoland who is a fan of yours, and boy, that'll pack the joint.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Vaughn Monroe.
My pleasure.